course, Bill Mattson was my PhD advisor, and one of the great lessons that he imparted on me when I was a student was the value of generalization for imploding this exponentially increasing body of fact that we're bombarded with ever-increasing research. And without some sort of framework, which may or may not be correct, to give us a way to think about it, we're faced with a massive collection of idiosyncratic facts that are really hard to process. And I think all the speakers in the first half, and especially Peter, talked about the importance of generalization. And what I want to do is talk about our thinking regarding plant defense and how it's evolved through the years. And for me, this started in 1982 when I was first made aware as a master's student of Bill's 1980 paper on nitrogen. I came in one day and found that one of my colleagues had thrown this on my desk and suggested that I should read it, and I did. As a horticulturist at the time, trying to make the switch or transition into ecology, I found it captivating, and that paper has really served as a foundation for the work that I've done ever since. I'll talk about that foundation, and then the extension of growth differentiation balance hypothesis that Bill and I attempted after was resurrected by Pete Lorio. And then I'm going to end up with some work that Carolyn Glenn, a postdoc, did to try to conduct a critical test of these ideas and then integrate this body of plant defense literature with the body of theory on adaptive plasticity in plants to stressful environments. And so this paper, other speakers have made reference to, was very profound. It was awarded a ISI Citation Classic Award in fairly short order after it was published within 13 years. This paper is perhaps most appreciated for its kind of synthesis of insect nutritional ecology and the role of nitrogen, as Andy mentioned, in insect diets. What I think is less appreciated by many people is that this paper also provided the foundation for plant defense theory based on resource availability. And I'm not going to read these, but you can look at these quotes from Bill's paper. And if you're familiar with carbon nutrient balance hypothesis as published by John Bryant et al. In 1983, you'll recognize that the fundamental premises that underlie that hypothesis were right there in Bill's paper. And in fact, John Bryant readily acknowledges that in conversation and also in citation in that paper. And so Bill really laid that framework for phenotypic plasticity in relation to soil nitrogen in plant defense. And then if you're familiar with resource availability model of Lissy Coley in 1985 on that related not so much to phenotypic plasticity but life history theory in plant defense, you'll see once again that the fundamental tenets of that model were presented and outlined by Bill in 1980 in his paper. And although I don't think Bill was familiar with Loomis's elaboration of growth differentiation balance hypothesis that was published in 1932 and was resurrected in Lorio in 1986, if you're familiar with that elaboration, that you can see there are some convergent evolution in the thinking regarding these models, and the main fundamental ideas that Bill and I elaborated on further in our review were outlined initially by Bill in 1980. And in fact, as I was going through this presentation, or preparing this presentation, going through his paper again, it reminded me that every idea I have is actually Bill's. In 1932, Loomis published this short paper, just a few pages, on growth differentiation balance hypothesis that was presented as an alternative to carbon-nitrogen ratio, which was kind of the prevailing paradigm at the time for thinking about environmental effects on the regulation of plant allocation strategies. didn't receive really a lot of attention until 1986, when Pete Lorio resurrected this hypothesis and was the first to apply it to plant insect interactions, in this case, southern pine beetle pine interactions. And here's a photograph of Pete measuring growth and defense in pines. And I thank Matt for Ayers for this photograph of Pete, who's also been very important influence on my career. In fact, I came into work one day at when I was in Bill's lab as a student, and I found the galley proofs from Pete's paper lying on my desk, and Bill suggested I read it, and I did, and I'm like, I don't really get this, but I learned if Bill tells me I should think about something, if I don't understand it, I realize that it's my limitation. Eventually, I was, I think, able to appreciate how profound that paper was, and started using that as a framework for thinking about my dissertation. In 1992, Bill and I published this paper, Extending the Growth Differentiation Balance Beyond Bark Beetle Interactions, to a comprehensive framework in which we attempt, anyway, to understand patterns of phenotypic plasticity and evolution of life history strategies in plant defense. And in a nutshell, this model is based on physiological trade-offs, resource-based trade-offs between growth and defense that have ecological consequences in terms of plants have to optimize some kind of compromises they have to make to deal with some conflicting ecological pressures, in this case, growth, defense versus competition with other plants, and the outcome of these conflicts lead to natural selection for evolutionary strategies in defense. Well, I think you can break the model down, as we published it in 92, across scales of biological organization, going from cellular and physiological through to evolutionary, and I'll address these in turn. At the cellular level, one of the key premises is that secondary metabolism is limited in immature dividing cells by physiological constraints, the lack of mature enzymatic machinery, the lack of compartmentation sites for avoiding autotoxicity until these cells become mature. Once cells stop dividing and start differentiating, secondary metabolism becomes much more prominent. Secondary metabolism is also limited, we postulate, by these resource-based trade-offs. And these become apparent at the level of the organ. Carbon utilized for secondary metabolism, not available for growth, and vice versa. So I think it's well established that plants have a limited resource budget to support their various physiological processes. And probably in the literature, the best documented is the trade-off between vegetative and reproductive growth, the so-called cost of reproduction or reproductive effort. But increasingly, empirical studies and reviews are providing substantial evidence for a similar trade-off between growth and secondary metabolism, primary and secondary metabolism. As one example, very nice study by Hahn and Lincoln in 94, where they quantified both the phenotypic cost of increased secondary metabolite production in terms of lost growth, as well as in a quantitative genetics design, the result of an increased evolution of secondary metabolite production. So another aspect which Bill hit on in his 1980 paper, in which John Bryant highlighted, and Terry Chapin, in a classic paper that was published in the same annual review. And in fact, this 1980 annual review of Ecology and Systematics may be one of the most important books ever published in the discipline of insect ecology, with Bill's paper, Chapin's paper on mineral nutrition of wild plants, Bryant's paper on plant defense strategies to mammals, and Peter Price's classic paper on tritrophic interactions, all four in the same issue. One of the key premises of this idea and this allocation trade-offs is that growth is much more sensitive to nutrient and water limitation than is photosynthesis on a leaf area basis. Now on a total leaf area, the plant is extremely sensitive to resource availability. And in fact, between species and within species, looking at variation and growth rate, the most important predicting variable is leaf area ratio, the ratio of total leaf area to total plant biomass. Explains much more variation in crop productivity and plant growth than does variation in photosynthesis rate or net assimilation rate. Here's a slide from an experiment we conducted with willows. This shows fertilization level, nitrogen in parts per million, but we also varied all the other essential nutrients in equal proportions. As we doubled nitrogen, we doubled phosphorus and so forth. And it's not too surprising to see that plant growth increases when you increase nutrient availability. Perhaps more surprising is this lack of effect on photosynthesis, some work that Carolyn Glenn did, and you see that photosynthesis rates remain high even in plants that had zero supplemental nutrients in this peat-based inert growing media. So their photosynthetic machinery clearly acclimates to low resource availability. And so here are plants from this study, and you can see that they're growing faster. They have the same photosynthesis rate. At the beginning of the experiment, these plants were all the same size by design. These were propagated cuttings. And so if they start out at the same size and they have the equal photosynthetic rates, how can the plants in the high nutrient treatment get bigger? Well, there's only one way, and that is because they're producing new leaves at a faster rate, and they're allocating more of their acquired photosynthate into the production of new leaf area, which pays, what's that thing on that used to happen to investments? Compounding interest. And so, you know, these new leaves that are being formed, the rate at their production is very environmentally dependent on indeterminate plants, and they're parasites on the rest of the plant. They're not photosynthetically self-supporting until they're about half or more expanded. And so photosynthate from these mature source leaves is driving this growth. And so any carbon that's exported via phloem transport out of the mature leaf into the expanding leaf is obviously not available in the mature leaf to support secondary metabolism. And we see, in fact, in this study, a negative correlation between relative shoot growth rate and total phenylpropanoid concentration, the total sum of phenolic glycosides and condensed tannins. At the whole plant level, this physiological trade-off is predicted to interact with environmental factors in a way that we predict that there will be a nonlinear parabolic response of secondary metabolism across an environmental gradient. And it's probably easier to visualize through a picture. As resource availability increases, we initially expect an increase in secondary metabolism followed by a decrease. And at high resource levels, growth is very rapid and net assimilation rate is not changing because it's not as sensitive to changes in these environments. Initially it is, and everything increases, but it levels off and the trade-off becomes apparent. And there's a couple implications to this hypothesis. One is that you can get different responses in, for example, in an experiment, depending on the initial resource status of the plant. And so, for example, in a very low resource environment and you increase water availability or nutrient availability, you predict that you would see positive correlations between secondary metabolism and growth, even in the face of a physiological trade-off, because the plant's income is also increasing. However, at higher levels of resource availability, where net assimilation rate is not being impacted, we predict this trade-off will translate into a negative correlation between growth and defense. At an ecological level, we strongly argued in our paper that this represents a case of adaptive phenotypic plasticity, not an incidental response, that plants don't have to make high levels of secondary metabolites in these resource-limited environments. They do it because it's adaptive, because these compounds protect plants from stress, and the evidence for that has increased dramatically, and also from herbivores where growth is limited and the ability to compensate is as well. rapid growth is adaptive in these high resource environments, so that plants avoid losing their resources to competitors. Reduced defense is an unavoidable consequence of the need to grow rapidly. From an evolutionary standpoint, we can predict that that there are will be adaptations that will minimize the slope or the cost of this trade-off. That selection will favor defenses that are more efficacious. If two structures have the same cost, selection will favor the more efficacious one. If you have two traits of equal efficacy, selection will favor the least costly. And there's various adaptations that we review that where plants can minimize the cost of defense in an evolutionary strategy. Nancy Stamp in a review pointed out that while there have been a lot of people that have cited this study, very few of the test have actually represented a good test because the conditions of these experiments really didn't meet the assumptions of trying to test, for example, for a quadratic response. And a quadratic response could explain some of the variation, for example, that Andy discussed in her drought analysis, drought stress. So Carolyn Glenn, who was just completing a postdoc, shown here with Bill, decided that she would organize a critical test of this hypothesis and try to also extend the domain by integrating this with models of adaptive plasticity. And so Carolyn organized a team with Colin Orion, Stig Larson, myself, and we met and decided, okay, what would be the best system and the best way to test this model? In terms of optimal allocation, the focus of these models have largely been on optimal root-shoot ratios and so forth, adaptive plasticity in response to environmental gradients. And Bloom in a classic paper outlined kind of the economic analogy for shifting resources in different environments. Engestad and Ogren have developed a pretty rigorous theoretical framework for this kind of plasticity, and that they argue that when an environment changes, and Mark this morning talked about how nutrient availability can change in a system, that plants then will reallocate their resources to acclimate to those changes. And they'll go through a lag phase where they're reorganizing their physiology, their root-shoot ratios are changing, and then they'll reach a new equilibrium. And when that equilibrium is achieved, it will be represented by a state of balanced growth where relative above-ground relative growth rate and below-ground relative growth rate become equal, and the root-shoot ratio equilibrates at the optimal level for that environment. And so this suggests then that as they acclimate to low fertility, their net assimilation rate will increase. And this suggests then that plants can move across this gradient in time even while in the same environment. As they acclimate to environment and their net assimilation rate increases, their secondary metabolism, for example, could increase from here to here just through acclimation over time. And so we studied this. We set up an experiment with Willows, this really nice computer-controlled fertigation system that the horticultural engineers have developed at our institution for delivering water and nutrient in very precise recipes. And so we had these five levels of fertility treatment. And then we did destructive harvest plants at various intervals, 23, 40, and 85 days, and looked at things like root-shoot ratio. And what we see is that after starting out at kind of an intermediate level, and in retrospect, this was just kind of a chance thing that our plants had this root-shoot ratio, the ones going to low nutrient treatments, the white and green, their root-shoot ratio shot up initially, but they overshot their equilibrium, came back down, and then stabilized. In the high nutrient treatments, the root-shoot ratio dropped down to basically equilibrium levels at a much lower level and then stabilized over the last 40 days. And this suggests that they, after this lag phase, they had reached an equilibrium allocation state. And then what we see then on these harvests is that initially there was no effect on net assimilation rate across the treatments. We're looking at a flat line across the resource gradient. Growth rate increasing as nutrient availability increased, and secondary metabolism decreasing, negative correlation as predicted by the sink limited half of that conceptual model. But on day 40, we saw a different pattern. And here we saw net assimilation rate had dropped in the lowest fertility treatment. Growth rate was still showing kind of an exponential pattern. But secondary metabolism had dropped in the low fertility treatment. And we see a significant quadratic response that is qualitatively consistent with that predicted by our model. However, by day 85, when we're back to the equilibrium state, we see that net assimilation rate had shot up in these plants that had acclimated. And we see that secondary metabolism also shot up in those zero nutrient plants. And the negative correlation between growth and defense had reestablished itself. And so we suggest then that this negative correlation is actually the equilibrium condition. This has some important implications for example, complex spatial and temporal patterns in host quality generated by the types of things that Mark showed earlier today. It's consistent with the idea that the effects of resources on secondary metabolism are dependent on the relationship between growth rate and net assimilation rate. And so studies, for example, that measure just growth and secondary metabolism, as Nancy Stamp pointed out, really aren't capable of testing these kind of ideas. I mean, you can learn from them, but you can't really test these hypotheses unless you're also measuring some index of carbon acquisition. And another important implication is this quadratic response, which really is a cornerstone prediction of the growth differentiation model that Bill and I laid out. Turns out it may just be a fleeting, ephemeral response that occurs during the lag phase while plants are going through a equilibrium, establishing equilibrium, and once they've acclimated and equilibrated, that negative correlation is the really the equilibrium situation, which may also point out why it's been hard to document that quadratic response. You have to harvest your plants at the right time if you're going to see it. I'll point out here to conclude that this equilibrium pattern that we see is extremely consistent with this centralized integrated stress response that Terry Chapin outlined in this paper, this model of plant allocation that is highly integrated into a system of responses that includes secondary metabolism, root-shoot ratio, specific leaf mass, and so forth. And the effects we saw were just right on the money in terms of what Chapin outlined in this paper of adaptive plant responses to stress. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention. I want to acknowledge Bill for his 24 years of mentoring and especially his friendship and support.
There's time for a couple questions.
Yep.
Dan, you dismissed that quadratic phase of acclimation as maybe not being so important because it's ephemeral. But I wonder if it lasts long enough, even over a week or two, you can actually really influence which herbivores come next, alter community.
Right, yeah. So that's a good point. I didn't really mean to apply that we dismiss it. It's ephemeral, but nutrient availability is constantly changing, as Mark showed. And so plants, the idea of plants in equilibrium is probably an ideal, that they're probably chasing moving targets as climate, weather, rain, insect outbreaks, and whatnot are changing these resource availabilities. And so probably the most important point there to emphasize was this idea of complex spatial temporal mosaics of host quality.
Do you expect to see the same pattern in non-leaf plants in terms of the trade-off between growth and secondary?
Would I expect to see the same kind of trade-offs in non-woody plants? It's been demonstrated in many cases in herbaceous plants. And even the quadratic response, for example, was documented in a really nice study in tomato by Rich Wilkins. Okay, thank you very much.